Get it together, they say. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Monday, July the 29th, and indeed, we are going to Tallahassee, the state capital of Florida, where in its second week, a group calling itself the Dream Defenders have been maintaining a two-week, so far, continuous protest urging Governor Rick Scott to declare a special session of the state legislature in order to examine certain contradictions, chief among them the Stand Your Ground law. Joining us now is Philip Agnew. He is the executive director of the Dream Defenders. Thank you, Philip, for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot. Suppose you tell us a bit about the Dream Defenders.
Well, we started a little bit over a year ago after the death of Trayvon Martin in the wake of national arrest about the lack or the delay in arrest of George Zimmerman. And so it was a group of students, young people from around the state who got together. We had a march for 40 miles in the name of arresting George Zimmerman and justice for Trayvon Martin. There was a great deal of confusion around the country and definitely in the state of Florida amongst young people about why or how this miscarriage of justice and the delay of an arrest could really happen. And so we decided to channel that energy into our march. And we weren't even an organization then. We were just a group of young people and students who were really angry about what had happened and wanted to draw attention to that angst in a really constructive way. And so a little over a year later, we've got chapters now at 8 universities around the state and really looking to continue to build and train youth organizers and young people in the three areas that we've outlined, or to combat the three areas that we've outlined in Trayvon's law. And we're built on nonviolent civil disobedience and training folks on how to organize in their communities. And we couldn't, you know, this moment here, though it was really confusing and perplexing and angering for a lot of folks, it gave a lot of young people an opportunity to not only in Florida but around the country to express that in some really constructive ways. And so we're just, like you said, 14 days have been in the Capitol continuously sleeping on the floors here, pushing and petitioning the governor to call this session.
Well, the governor did have a sort of kind of meeting, and in that sort of kind of meeting said, forget it, there's not going to be a special session. What has been the upshot of that?
Well, I mean, we expected a no. You know, if this was easy, everybody would do it, and, the governor would have relented already. So I think it really galvanized our base. It really mobilized a lot of young people to come up here. And people come in throughout the day to support us and to show their support and to sit down with us. And during the evenings, there are even more people here to stay overnight. And, it was the beginning of a dialogue with the governor. We don't believe the governor to be a monster. We believe he has a heart. He loves children. And so we expressed to him in the form of our individual stories and our collective narrative that we're here peacefully but firm, and that this is a way forward, and you have an opportunity to come to the table with young people and really make Florida into a place where young people can grow and flourish and don't have to worry about being criminalized.
What is the objective in getting a special session?
We want them to talk, discuss, and eventually ratify or sign into law our Trayvon's law, what we're calling the Trayvon Martin Civil Rights Act. And it's an act or laws or set of laws that address the issues that affect the youth community. And what we've done is put them into three easy categories that speak to a very complex problem. But what we've done is we want the bill or the act to address racial profiling in the state, to address the school-to-prison pipeline that where Florida ranks number one in the country. And we want to repeal the Stand Your Ground. And we feel if we can bring to the table and have a substantive debate and discussion around these three issue areas, we can present a slate or a palette of laws that counteract them, that eliminate them as being so prevalent in our communities, and really move forward.
With the governor already giving an indication that he's not interested in declaring a special legislative session to discuss these issues, there mm-hmm. is another way, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. That is to have, you know, 20% of lawmakers sign up and say they support it, and then for an that triggers an automatic poll of all lawmakers. And so we're going through that avenue right now. We've gotten enough senators to sign up and say they support it, or senators and representatives, rather, to sign on and say they support it. And so we're in the process of getting their official letter sent over to our Secretary of State so that that poll can begin. And that's the second way to do it. And there's a few other ways that our goal at the end of the day is to have Trayvon's law passed. And so we want it urgently and quickly in the form of a special session, but there are many other ways to get that done. And we're hosting our own special session starting tomorrow here in the Capitol.
Now, when you say you're hosting your own special session, mm-hmm. what do you mean?
Well, we're the young people here, and young people from around the state and thought leaders and subject experts from around the country are going to be joining us in a series of discussions and debates that surround our three issue areas that I talked about before. And so what we're going to do is compile with the court reporter present a list or a number of testimonies, firsthand eyewitness testimonies to how young people are affected by these issue areas. We're going to provide expert testimony on each of the areas. And, you know, we'd like to say when we got here 2 weeks ago, we presented what the Trayvon Martin Act could look like. And by the end of this session, we'll have a good idea of what it would look like. And so we're continuing to try, in lieu of the governor refusing to do so, we're trying to show some leadership and get some work done. And hopefully whenever that special session is called, we'll have a great, great product for them to build off of, develop, and eventually sign.
But logistically, you're in the hallway. how are you going to get this done?
Right. Well, we've requisitioned and secured some space at the old Capitol.
Okay.
So we're going to bring some new business into the old Capitol, and we're looking forward to that. And, yeah, we are. Logistically, this whole experience is a hassle. Because it's not the best place or base of operations to be in the Capitol for an entire day and all night. But we've made do with what we have, and there are a lot of national and local partners who've really supported us and made sure that when we do leave here, whenever it is, that we're leaving out of here with a victory.
Now, when you do leave there, let's suppose to do the special session, does it mean that you give, from a logistical point of view, you would be locked out of the occupying spots that you have now?
While we're having the session, we'll have folks still occupying the Capitol or occupying the governor's office. So we're just, you know, kind of spreading our resources and making sure that we've got a presence in every place that we can. So, like I said, logistically it is different, but the old Capitol is right across the street out here. So, mm-hmm. You know, we'll get back here before 5 and make sure we're in here. Make sure we're in here before the doors close for the evening, because we've kind of grown to like the Capitol floor.
Now, in a very interesting way, what the Dream Defenders are doing is, in effect, pointing to either the inadequacy or the unwillingness of established leadership to really take bold action.
Mm-hmm.
Has the action of the defenders, of the Dream Defenders, in some way brought upon itself a kind of negative reaction, or are you finding that the legislators are more positive than negative?
Well, I think for the most part they're positive, or they or unresponsive, which I think is a negative as well. But overwhelmingly positive from the folks we've had conversations with. And then the folks that don't want to talk to us try to find ways to avoid the issue altogether. Public opinion right now, I believe, is on our side. Most folks want better futures for their children. Most folks want, or all folks want, safer streets, safer communities. Most folks agree that the Stand Your Ground law should be discussed and given a place of debate or put in a place of debate. And most folks don't want kids going into jails from elementary school. You understand? So, you know, the governor's office has remained pretty silent since that last meeting, and that's fine. I think, you know, avoidance is going to be their tactic, and it really can come to bite them once election season comes around next year. But overall, lawmakers that we've had the opportunity to speak with have been supportive. Now we've just got to get them to stand with us.
I see that you've gotten very strong support from the NAACP Conference of Chapters leader. I see you've gotten support from Harry Belafonte, who showed up in person. That must have been a very good shot in the arm for you. But generally, do you think the political apparatus generally is supportive of you?
Well, no, I didn't say that. Just the ones that have spoken to us. I think overwhelmingly, you know, most people are pleasant, and we had the opportunity to speak to a few in person, and they've heard our concerns. And the support from national allies, et cetera, has been overwhelmingly positive. And I mean that literally. You know, most organizations that we've spoken with have issued letters of support to us or have sent or dispatched some resources that we needed to us. So, yes, I think public opinion and public will right now is on our side. It will continue to be on our side because of the way that we conduct ourselves in truth and honesty and in respect. And we don't intend to leave, you know, whether or not, you know, I think folks from both sides of the aisle have a vested interest in making Florida safer and more beautiful and more prosperous. So as we continue to reach out to lawmakers this week, I anticipate more coming to our side, voicing their opinions on the issue. But for the ones that we haven't spoken with, we're looking to reach out to them this week as well.
Well, speaking of resources, I was listening to a talk that you had to give to the troops about the fact that they had to put up with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, at least until today. How can people be of assistance to Dream Defenders?
You can go to our website, dreamdefenders.org. There's a donate link there if you would like to donate in that way. And if you have if you want to donate yourself, your person, come down to the Capitol, come to Tallahassee, you know, for a small window of time. Florida has become an epicenter for racial discord, and we think we have an opportunity to change that around to a place of racial discourse and moving forward in progress. So I would say if you want to donate and you can't make it here, go to the website, click on donate, and you can donate there. But if you can get here to the Capitol, we'd love to have you. We'd love to have your support. Write us on our, you know, through our website if you want to offer up any information or advice. One thing we know is that we don't know everything. So we're always looking for great advice for how we can make this thing the best it can be, and so we can come out of here whenever we walk out of here happy and with our heads high.
One of the things that was remarkable, Philip, that in looking at the group, I see a great cross-cultural representation. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us about how that was achieved?
Well, the same way, you know, we've done everything with honesty and openness and being genuine. You know, one of our principles is relational organizing, which is based on meeting people where they are, learning more about them, building a genuine relationship with them that lasts. And that's one of the founding tenets of our organization, to connect with people that do not look like you, that may not sound like you, that may not even believe in the values that you believe in as well, and to really begin to build with them. And it's very intentional. It is very, very intentional. We don't believe that you can combat the world as it is with another image of the world as it is. It's got to be a vision of the world as it should be and could be. And so there's cross-cultural, there's diversity in almost every area of human condition represented in our group, because the door is open for everyone to come and fight for a better future. And so we're all here together. We're all in it together, and we believe that in our souls. I live with a Cuban guy and a Palestinian guy. And so it goes into my personal life as well. We're all friends from college. We all have the utmost love and respect for each other, and we all want better for the world. And so we shouldn't divide ourselves just by how the world divides us, because we don't see the world in that way.
Well, what's next? What's in the immediate future right now, yes, as you see it?
Yes. Get to Florida, come here, we'll be here, come to the Capitol, we'll be here. We anticipate, as we have since day one, a special session being called and our issues being debated and discussed. We'll also be engaging in one of the most aggressive voter registration drives the state has ever seen in the coming weeks and months. And we anticipate going around the state compiling more stories from young people about how they've been affected by the issues, and then engaging them on how they can be a part of the solution as well. So we want to grow, we want to expand, but what's more important to us is that we grow smartly and grow effectively and are really able to change. And we do believe we can change the world, but not in the way other folks may say it. We believe we've got a good plan, and we're going to execute that plan and do it with love and peace, and we're going to win. We believe that we'll win.
So is that where you got the Dream Defenders from, the name?
The name? Okay, if I have time, I have a funny story about how we got our name. We had a conference call before that first march I told you about a little over a year ago. Mm-hmm. And it was about 150 people on that call. And towards the end of the call, a young lady spoke up and said, "Hey, I wish you all much luck on your march. I'm a little bit older. I think this group is for younger folks, and I love that. I think you all should do it. But I just want you to know before I get off the phone that you all truly are like defenders of the dream to me. You all are really defending the dream, in my opinion. And I just want to congratulate you and give you all my love." And so from that day, we called ourselves the Dream Defenders. We don't know who that young lady was. She's never made herself known even since that call. And that's how we got our name.
How about that? Well, Philip, this group has been a beacon in many, many ways. It is a beacon to the old way of doing things. It's a beacon mm-hmm. about the promise of the future and about mm-hmm. the potential that we have within our own communities for mm-hmm. brand new leadership that is willing to take on the responsibility of leadership. And this is extraordinary so far that you've gotten the kind of response that you've gotten from, across the board. So I would like to come back to you several times in the next few days just to keep tabs on where things are and how things are going.
Yes, absolutely. I would love to. I appreciate the support that you're giving me by providing your microphone to our calls, and just look forward to any conversation we'll have and just building with anyone else that wants to build, and I really appreciate it. I'm humbled by the response we've gotten, but we think we're on to something, and we're going to keep pushing.
Thank you so much, Philip, and good luck. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Again, Dream Defenders is dreamdefenders.org. They can use a lot of help in terms of resources. Like I said, the last that I heard from Dream Defenders was the fact that they were kind of the folks that watch or given the responsibility of watching this group as they occupy the corridors of the state building, that they didn't want food coming in, so they had a pretty rough weekend without food and water readily available, so they could use some help, and that is dreamdefenders.org. I'd like to talk a bit now about this whole question about young men, black men, and older black men, The Black and Puerto Rican Legislative Caucus, actually the Black Caucus specifically, had scheduled a meeting way before the verdict came in about the status of Black men and Black boys in the United States. On the one hand, you could say, my gosh, I mean, how many times do we have to have these kinds of meetings? And then on another, another hand, you say, well, it's at least important to have these meetings, to have these hearings. What will they do? What are people prepared to do? We just heard from young people who organize themselves and are doing quite an effective job. And it's a wonderful sign to see this kind of leadership emerging. And then you contrast that with leadership that seems stuck in some kind of a time warp. It's not going forward, really. It's just treading water and not necessarily moving forward, not necessarily advancing in these critical areas. And we keep repeating the same lines, the same frustrations all the time. But there was at least one interesting contribution, and that came from Professor Michael Eric Dyson, who is a sociologist at the university, at Georgetown University. And he gave a statement that kind of reflects a sense of what needs to be done, how these issues affecting young Black men and Black men generally across the board and young Black boys in the society. But why Black men and why Black boys? Because, as I have said on this program so many times, the issues confronting the African American community themselves as a whole, the community as a whole, is suffering inordinately. But within the community, we have these subsets of groups that are even more attacked, more under incredible duress for all kinds of reasons. And Black men and Black boys, as it came, you know, to the fore in the case of Trayvon Martin, here's a kid just trying to get back home. And for some reason, is seen, just physically presents a threat in the mind of somebody else. And this is not an unusual story. Even the President of the United States himself had to admit, people regarding him as a threat. So this has been a long-standing story. And this was how Michael Eric Dyson suggested that the problem be dealt with in order to move forward from this point. As I said, we've had these discussions many, many times, but just listen, it's a long enough clip, but it would be important to listen to, and then we'll come back right after that.
To talk about young men, teens, and youth, I myself was a teen father. Lived on welfare for 3 years, didn't go to college until I was 21. So I understand some of the existential drama that attaches to Black boys, males, and men who have been particularly subject to the arbitrary stigma and pathology that attaches to young men in American society, but leave aside the incredible valor and the vitality of their struggles to claim decent spaces in American society. What do teens who are Black and male face in our culture? Well, let's be honest, there's a cultural backdrop. All Black people live under suspicion. Trayvon Martin is but the most ready and apt metaphor. Trayvon Martin is but the most ready and apt metaphor for the suspicion to which we are subject. Black humanity has been suspected from the beginning of our sojourn in American society. I don't need to give a history lesson about that. The great Thomas Jefferson, the architect of Monticello and the Declaration of Independence, also wrote notes on Virginia, where he questioned the cerebral abilities and the intellectual acuity and the reason of black people, even as at night, retiring from his study, engaged in relations with a young woman whose loins trapped his logic. So that the reality of our humanity being under suspicion is critical as the backdrop to understand the unfolding and evolving perception of black people in America. Our humanity has been questioned and our intelligence has been questioned. As a result of that, black teens inherit a culture where the suspicion and skepticism about their humanity and their intelligence are part and parcel of what we deal with on the daily. This is why, for instance, to echo Mr. Johns, we not only talk about black male stereotypes, we talk about black female stereotypes, because had Rachel Gentile been believed, had the stereotypical representation that articulates her as somehow subhuman, and not just from white Americans, but black too, skeptical about what she is, speaking three languages, perhaps her testimony would have been believed and the outcome of the trial could have been shaped, because black women are under vicious assault as well. And as a result of that, mothers mired in poverty help young black men come to birth, and both of them receive the calumny and the slander of this culture. So young teens inherit a culture that unconsciously and consciously engages in the skepticism and suspicion of their existence. The educational system into which they are thrust expels them at a rate 2.5 times greater than their white peers. So you in school and you get kicked out for stuff that your white peers don't. Not only that, they are subject to detention and also put in special education programs that target them specifically as being less capable intellectually. What happens then is that they are also subject to the criminal justice system through nonviolent drug offenses. Even though the self-reporting of young white people suggests they do drugs about the same rate, if not a little bit more, than do black and other kids, it stands to reason. If you got more disposable cash, you got more time and capacity and ability to engage in nefarious activities on the extra legal sense. So the point is that white kids are doing drugs in the same way black kids are, but white kids are not being put in jail because they are not suspected. But because they are not viewed as likely to engage in that kind of behavior, they are not profiled. And so young black men, teens in general, are profiled, not just by the police department when they go into stores. Retail profiling, you ain't got to be a teen to be subject to that. I got a black card and yet I'm profiled, though I painted it last night, it was green. But the point is that we are subject to that kind of racial and retail profile. The disproportionate number of black males who are put in the criminal justice system suggests to us that there is a targeting of African American men, particularly teens, beginning in the 14, 15, 16 year age range, that makes them subject to adult penalties in the criminal justice system. Many of these kids are tried as adults, and the book, so to speak, of the law is thrown against them, even for first time offenses. And then even more broadly, stereotypes of black male and youth identity. We could have an empirical crush to verify the assault of the state upon vulnerable black people, but I want to weave a narrative and tell a story to make you feel the compelling character of the assault on young black teens. The reality is these stereotypes are out there. Even noted Washington Post columnists say that, let's be honest, the hoodie is the uniform of the criminal. Not for Mark Zuckerberg, not for Bill O'Reilly, not for Gerardo, all of whom, with the exception of Mr. Zuckerberg, have assaulted black people and black teens for being engaged in the self-perpetuation of a legacy of assault upon them because of the clothing they wear. So that this sartorial profiling, this clothing profiling, suggests that black people can't even dress with the same kind of freedom that our white peers do. And in this case, young black teens can't, because they will be automatically assumed to be a thug. Now, some people say, well, it's your problem. It's hip-hop culture. Hip-hop created this. Really? Before the rise of hip-hop culture 30, 35 years ago, black men were being profiled. Black teens were being seen as preternaturally given to inclinations to be criminal. So excuse me, that's not the case. Now, has some element of hip-hop culture glorified and reinforced the devaluing of black life? Of course it has. But it's also spoken against it. Tupac said just the other day, I got lynched by some crooked cops, and to this day, them same cops on the beat getting major pay, but when I get my check, they taking tax out, so we paying the cops to knock the blacks out. Jay-Z said, God forgive me for my brash delivery, but I remember vividly what these streets did to me. Picture me allowing these clowns to nitpick at me, portray me like a pickaninny. So they are combating the vicious misrepresentation of black masculine identity by resorting to the very violence that is critical to American culture and American identity, and the sense of machismo that young black people appropriate has been given to them by a culture that creates laws like Stand Your Ground, and that creates a gun industry that is obsessed to a nearly erotic intensity with guns as the manifestation of their manhood. They ain't invented the game, they plan it in their own way. So the reality is, how do we deal with the stereotypical representations of young black people? And now our friends on the right suggest it's black on black crime. Where you been? We've been talking about that. When Newtown happens, cameras are there. When Aurora happens, cameras are there. When Chicago happens, cameras are not there. But now we pathologize those young black people. And by the way, black people have been marching from time immemorial against the vicious legacy of white supremacy that occupies black minds, that leads us to kill each other, to hate each other, to despise the very presence that we represent. So we know about black on black crime as a reflection of a broader pathology, and both of them must be arrested. But the reality is, politicians don't show up from the White House down to the local level when black children's bodies are at stake. And when they do show up, they give us lectures about black family structure, when we can look at most white people who commit crimes and they have obviously familial challenges that need to be articulated. And black on black crime, true, 94% of black people who are murdered by black people, but 86% of white people are murdered by white people. White on white crime is a reality in America today, but not assumed as such. So black teens are facing a state that stigmatizes them, a culture that demonizes them, a pop culture that both expresses their intent to be greater than they are, but reinforces some of their vulnerability. And so I would suggest then that what we do are a few things. First of all, the educational system has to be taken seriously as a locus classicus for the battles we need to wage. And how do we do that? We got to stop demonizing and stigmatizing our children. We've got to create alternative structures to admit multiple forms of learning. People learn in multiple ways. I mean, Jay-Z is a high school graduate. Tupac dropped out. Nas, eighth grade dropout. Yet these are rhetorical geniuses. Who's wrong? The school or them? There's a difference between learning and education on the one hand and schools on the other. Schools are the institutional matrices that articulate our expression to educate each other and hold each other accountable. Learning is about the desire to be educated for a lifetime. And so we have to converge these two disparate meanings in some instances, figure out ways to acknowledge our children's learning styles, not to stigmatize and demonize them, don't send them to jail if they have a behavioral challenge, and figure out ways not to put them into detention, which becomes a feeding cell to jail, which becomes a warehouse for prison. Secondly, we've got to reduce the penalties for nonviolent drug offenses and for zero tolerance policies. Now, we are not here to have affirmative action for thugs, so to speak. We are here to say that everybody doing it, everybody ought to be taken in the same way to jail, or everybody should be given a break. Born poor and black, born with your back against the wall, many people, the President of the United States, in his brilliant memoir, talks about abusing marijuana. So had he been caught, put in jail, stigmatized, he'd have been a well-achieving young man, I'm sure, but he might have been standing on the sideline going, you know what, I could have been president. Yeah, right. So the reality is we have to be very careful how we stigmatize our youth, and the public policies that we put in place and the laws must not unnecessarily, unduly, and disproportionately stigmatize those children. Thirdly, the president made a remarkable statement on race, finally, and it is good that the president stood up. It was a result of pressure. We understand that. He said, initially I said, Trayvon could have been my son. But look at the metaphorical and analogical shift he made. He said, but no, I could have been Trayvon. And I would add, if I were the speechwriter for Mr. Obama, let me Dysonize that. Not only could you have been Trayvon 35 years ago, you Trayvon now. Right? Why? And I'll end. Because they are profiling Mr. Obama in the White House, asking about your transcripts from a man whose hair is thinner even than his skin, questioning you, trumping you in a very serious and vicious fashion, from people asking to see your birth certificate as if you're not American. You did it the way people said they wanted to be done. You went to Columbia, graduated, Harvard Law School, and graduated. You don't wear a hood. It can't be about a hoodie. It can't be about the demonization of a certain kind of sartorial choice. It is about the way in which black masculinity expresses a menace and a threat in American culture, both consciously and unconsciously, that needs to be decoupled in the collective imagination of America. And then finally, when we see these as structural problems, when we see that young girls are being demonized, put in prison more often as well, subject to the kind of vicious stereotypes that I talked about in regard to Rachel Gentile, and that they, along with young black boys, are the recipients of the outrageous indignity of being assumed not to be intelligent and not to be human. And so as I close, my plea and prayer is that as we craft social and public policy, we ask the White House to once again be a bully pulpit. Mr. Obama wrote one of the most brilliant memoirs on race we have. It would be like Michael Jordan was in the White House but couldn't talk about basketball. Mr. Obama is acutely sensitive and keenly informed about the complicated matter. And the speech he delivered the other day was yet but a beginning. Now we need him and others to use their spots, spaces, and spirits in this culture to not only edify the conversation and to inform the analysis, but at the end of the day, to recognize that young black teens are children of God who deserve every protection. Because if those women on the jury understood Trayvon as their child, they may have felt his blood calling from the ground where George Zimmerman laid him to his rest.
Well, that was Professor Michael Eric Dyson testifying before the Congressional Black Caucus hearing on black men and boys. As I said, the hearing had been scheduled before the verdict in this case, but it was meant to bring attention to this particular population of black men and boys, and they, in both instances, are under extraordinary pressure and extraordinary oppression in our country today. Well, we are moving along much faster than I thought we would be, but I wanted to get to a subject. I think we'll do that tomorrow. I was going to talk about the Democratic Party and its so-called standards, referring specifically to Mr. Wiener and Mr. Spitzer, but we can get to that tomorrow. And instead, why don't we just take your calls? We'll take this fast break and come back to your calls for the rest of the program today at 888-874-4888. That's the Soul Jazz Orchestra with People, People. And this is Lead Stories on PRN.FM, 888-874-4888. What have you heard today that is of interest to you that made you stop and think? Let me know. Give me a call and let's talk about that. We have a few minutes still available We can take a call or two before we close out the program today. Tomorrow, then, I'll talk about the other subject I didn't get to today, and that is the so-called standards of the Democratic Party. We seem to have quite a few interesting people with some interesting baggage, and one wonders about the standards of the Democratic Party. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. And we'll be also talking about the case, the appeal case, involving Miss Marissa Alexander. We'll be talking about that with her lawyer handling the appeal. All right. So we have some time. If you want to call, this would be good, a good time to do it. 888-874-4888. Now, what we learned today was pretty interesting. I thought the Dream Defenders, when you look at them, they're a young group of people, students, college students, and they are taking the responsibility. They're not just saying, fight the power. They're saying, be the power. Be the power. And so they have demonstrated a boldness that has long been anticipated. We were waiting to see something like that, and it's very refreshing that they have come forward and that they are going about this business in a very methodical way and in a way that inspires hope and inspires a great deal of positive feeling. Harry Belafonte, as I said, came to see them personally, and some others, other people have come in and out and have been giving them great support. I'm hoping that we could find it in ourselves as well to account for ourselves with the group, dreamdefenders.org, to help them with some of the basics that they would need. As I said, they had not really been eating well in the last couple of days because the authorities have not made it easy for food and water and so forth to get to them. It's a way of just trying to get them out of the building. But so far, they have remained adamant and they have remained strong and committed. So when you see this kind of leadership, and especially among young people, and I talked about that last week, that young people get this. Young whites especially get the whole idea about moving aside the notion of privilege and supremacy and getting back into a scenario where they understand that they have work to do as well. And this is one of the things I have talked about on the show, that the liberal community, if you will, the progressive community, has to get over a whole bunch of racist contradictions and get involved in doing the work of dismantling racism within their community. And that's serious. That's just the way it is. And to see that they're doing it, and this was evidenced in the various marches all across the country in support of justice for Trayvon Martin, where you saw an outpouring of all kinds of people. And that's a sign that this thing is resonating at the heart of truth and justice. And there are so many efforts to demonize the young man, to make him basically responsible for the fact that he was killed in the way he was killed. And as I said, if people had a sense that the criminal justice system did work, you know, in an impartial way, even if the verdict was disappointing, they would have dealt with it. But it was so clearly lopsided. It was so clearly wrong. It was so clearly prejudiced. It was so clearly insufficient that it just outraged anybody with a conscience. This is just not the right way that it should go. There's something fundamentally wrong here. And the response was at that level. And that is why I said that young kids are getting it. And oddly enough, much of it had to do with the role of hip-hop. Yes, it's misogynistic in many ways, and like anything else, in every field of endeavor, you have good and you have bad. You have the kind of hip-hop music that is just absolutely putrid. But then you also have hip-hop music that is extremely revolutionary and very forward-thinking. And when people are converging along those lines and they get to a dialogue, they get to understand that they too are, in fact, impacted by these contradictions, and they become involved. And that is a positive thing. So it is, in effect, a thing to behold and to encourage and to support. When we see these kinds of movements emerging, you can't but support them. You know, you have to give them some kind of indication that they're doing the right thing and they're standing up. And they're standing up in the midst of an unwillingness or an incapacitation of established leadership. You know, in the middle of all of this, the established leadership, for the most part, just kind of laid down. Certainly in Florida, the established black leadership hasn't really had very much to say. They're just there like bumps on a log. But it takes this kind of effort to dislodge them, to confront them, to let them know that they're not the only answer anymore, that there are alternatives, and the alternatives are being formed as we speak. I know there are people forming other parties. People are looking at other political systems and answers. And that is what needs to happen. Move away from the establishment. They are not the answer. They won't be the answer either. They just can't be the answer. So you have to form something new. When you see something new that is worthy of support, support it. And these young people deserve that kind of support. Again, dreamdefenders.org. Go to the site and see what they're about and see what they're accomplishing. And in your own way, see if you can help them accomplish what it is they set out to do. It is a very good and noble cause, and it's something that I think we ought to let them know that we are listening to them, we are observing them, and we are supporting them. Okay. Well, I want us to do a couple of things this week. We will get to a very uncomfortable point in this program, and that is when we start talking about race in very serious terms, confronting it. And we have to lead up to that. We just can't jump into it because not everybody's going to be ready. But we have to take on this discussion because the evidence suggests that there's wholesale denial of where we are all around. And people have just got to get a wake-up call on the issue of race. And we have to understand that it is not just one group's job, it's everybody's job to dismantle. So we'll talk to each other tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening today. Take care.